And this is KPCW. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 806, 49 degrees, currently here in Old Town Park City. Also reporting 50 degrees in the Heber Valley. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Les. Sorry about that. Yes, we are enjoying us some beautiful sunshine again as we kick off the day. Now, as we began the day, we were dealing with some smoke and haze coming in from the north and northwest. But as we go throughout the afternoon, we may see a little bit more of that increasing. So I do want you to know that while we are going to continue with that sunshine throughout the day, we may see a little bit more of that smoke and haze sneaking back into the sky. So just kind of keep that in mind. But it still should be mostly sunny out there with those temperatures climbing into the 80s for the most part across the Heber Valley. And we're looking at the low 80s there, upper 70s to low 80s in Park City. But should be an absolutely beautiful day. Now, I say get outside and enjoy today because we will have some changes making its way in as we go into the next 24 hours. And that's going to be a change of some warmer temperatures. So the sunshine will stick around as we get into our Friday, but temperatures will start off very nice and comfortable. We're talking probably in the upper 30s and low 40s in the Heber Valley, but 40s likely in Park City as well. But as we get into the afternoon, that dry air will heat up quickly. So we're looking at the sunshine and highs in the low 80s in Park City on Friday, and we'll be in the upper 80s to near 90 in the Heber Valley by the afternoon hours. And then it continues to warm as we go into the weekend as we get a smidge more humidity sneaking back into the area. So we'll call it sunny to partly cloudy for your weekend with temperatures climbing into the low to mid 80s in Park City with highs in the upper 80s to near 90 as we go throughout the weekend and across the Heber Valley. So while we're going to be looking at lots of sunshine, it will be noticeably warmer as we go throughout the upcoming holiday weekend. And then as we head into your Labor Day itself, right now we've got partly cloudy skies. There will be a slight chance of an isolated pop-up shower storm. Again, continuing to look at the data this morning, we're just not seeing a ton of monsoon moisture coming in, which is great news for all of those outdoor plans. But we don't want you to completely ignore the weather. Just know there is about a 20% chance that we could see a pop-up isolated storm in parts of the area, but it should not be a washout, should not be enough to really have to cancel your outdoor plans. Just be aware when thunder roars, head indoors. And then as we go throughout the middle of next week, we're going to see those temperatures staying on the warm side, but there are signs by the middle of next week that a cold front will be approaching, and that could start to lower the temperatures by the second half of next week. But between the beginning and the second half of next week, we will be dealing with that warmer weather. So get ready for a primarily dry and warm holiday weekend, including Labor Day. But overall, a very nice day for today. Leslie.
Okay, Cedric. And so just so you know, here in the Park City area, we call it Miner's Day.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. I did not know that.
Okay. Oldest celebration that the Park City has.
Really? Yeah. Wow. Well, it looks like I'm going to have to get myself up there to Miner's Day here going on this weekend.
That's right. Okay. Thank you. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the Local News Hour, we'll be checking in with our trails report in just a minute. Also later on, Summit County Councilmember Candace Hart will be recapping yesterday's county council meeting. Dawn Roll and Alicia O'Meara with Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History will have details on their upcoming fundraiser. And finally, Park City Summit County Arts Council Marketing and Community Relations Manager Kendall Kelly will be joined by Kimmel Arts Center Executive Director Aldi Milliken with more information about this month's gallery stroll happening Friday night, as well as the opening of the new Kimball exhibit. Right now on the phone with us, we have Laura Anthony from Mountain Trails Foundation with our Mountain Trails Report. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie, and happy Thursday, Park City. We've got quite a bit going on out on the trails this week and weekend, so I'll just start at the top. The rail trail bridges are getting replaced. Park City Municipal has invested in that hugely, and so there is a very large mess over there. They've got the bridges under construction, so stay clear of that. They do have a go-around on the kind of on the mountain side of the rail trail, so if you are I'm trying to think, just before the Richardson Flat, where those where the bridges are, the famous bridges, everybody knows them. Stay away from those. Maybe pick another place to ride. If you need to go down that area as a means of transportation, then definitely use the alternate route. Looks like we have the Point to Point is Saturday, so that's a big race. That will be a huge trail impact. However, it is a rolling impact, so it's not really that big a deal if you're smart about the places you choose to ride. They will start in Round Valley. They'll work their way through Prospector, Deer Valley, Park City Mountain, Canyons, the Utah Olympic Park, and they'll end in the Canyons area in the afternoon, early evening. So if you see people out there who are looking extra haggard on their mountain bikes and happen to have a race plate on, you might want to give them just a little bit of space. They are racing a very, very hard race, and probably appreciate some cheering on. Looks like we've got Basin doing a runabout parking lot construction is underway, and the Lower Olympic Parkway parking lot is impacted there. It looks like they do have, if you're going to take your dog out to the run amok off-leash area, be aware that there are openings in the fence and the machinery is active in the area, so maybe not such a great place to hang out with the pups this weekend. I don't know what the finish date on that is. I would imagine probably a week or so. Maybe we'll have more information on that next week for you, or you can go to Basin Rec and check out the notices there. I think that's it. Scrolling through the messages, that looks like we are all done. Hope to see you out there this weekend. Stay cool and have a great day.
Okay, thanks, Laura. Well, affordable housing advocates gathered at the Park City Library Tuesday to share the results of a new study. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports they argue affordable housing has several economic benefits.
The study was coordinated by the nonprofit Mountain Lands Community Housing Trust and was funded by the Park City Chamber's Sustainable Tourism Grant Program. The report concludes that affordable housing has many economic, environmental, and community benefits. They include reducing commutes and greenhouse gas emissions, filling local jobs with new residents, along with increases to household spending, sales taxes, and property taxes. The study also claims investments in affordable housing could offset the need to create more parking and increase enrollment in local schools, which brings in more state funding. Andrew Knutson, a consultant who conducted the study for Mountain Lands, says Summit County is relying more and more on commuters to fill jobs.
Households making less than $75,000 a year have decreased by 17% since 2010, while at the same time, households making $200,000 or more have increased by nearly 300%. So households that have been earning their net worth from outside the region are bringing that into the region. And locals who are earning wages based on the local economy are not able to compete.
By estimating the costs of commuting, emissions, unfilled jobs, and other variables, he says creating more housing for local workers has an economic basis.
The bottom line, the big takeaway, is that there is a return on investment. On a rental project, we estimate that there is a return to the community of $585,000 annually from the economic activity generated by that dwelling unit and the impact it has on the economy. Assuming $100,000 investment, there's a return 5.8 times the return.
Polly Mendoza was among the more than 50 residents who attended the presentation Tuesday. Mendoza lives in affordable housing and spoke about her family's struggles sharing a cramped studio apartment while waiting more than 2 years for a deed-restricted unit.
Park City is a beautiful place and it should not just be for the rich. It should be for those of us who work here and we work hard and we make this city run. And I've known families, as I'm sure many of you have, who've had to move away from Park City because they can't afford it here.
It's estimated that 12% of Park City's workforce lives in the 84060 zip code. In 2016, the Park City Council set a goal to create 800 new affordable housing units by 2026. Park City Chamber Director of Community and Government Affairs Becca Gerber was on the council at the time and says there's still plenty of room to improve.
They've moved a long way. They've made a lot of progress. They still have some units to go, but it does feel like the conversation has moved away from housing over the past few years, and we want to refocus this conversation.
The group says they'd like to see Summit County set a housing unit production goal similar to Park City. The full affordable housing study can be found at kpcw.org. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Joining me now on the phone with a recap from yesterday's Summit County Council meeting, I have Council Member Candace Hart. Good morning, Candace.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. How are you doing?
Doing great. So let's start with the Kimball Junction traffic study. County staff presented alternatives to the so-called Alternative B, which was an option for Kimball Junction where 224 would be sunk into the ground, Ute Boulevard and Olympic Parkway then would pass above it. But UDOT has screened this one out. So is this officially dead, Plan B?
Plan B, or B plus as we were calling it, seems to be dead at this point. So we, right now, it looks like plan, what they refer to as A or C, are what our options are. But we're gonna go back. I mean, we'll get to it, I'm sure, as we unpack this a little bit, but we're thinking about modifying C and creating, call it C.2.
All right, so the, as you mentioned, the county had proposed alternative B. Why didn't UDOT bite for that?
Well, they looked at a couple things, as I understand it. One was cost, that seemed to be, they had an objection to, but the other one was, because, you know, their focus really is like throughput or speed of cars, and it, though it moved traffic, we liked it because we thought it moved pedestrians and other things better, but it didn't hit their metrics for the movement of cars, and so that's the primary reason they ruled it out.
Okay, so my understanding of the options now, the council likes alternative C. This is the $40 million fix. Can you explain what alternative C entails?
Yeah, so, well, and I should say, just so anybody knows, A was one where you got off of 80 a little earlier, and it put you on what is called Landmark Drive over by the outlets, and you came up along the Whole Foods. And so that turned that little road into a five-lane road. And that's part of what our resistance is there. We just think the impact to the pedestrians would be too much. So what C does is C brings you up to the normal off-ramp, and then as you're going down 224, all the turns become two lanes. So every left turn is like two lanes going, and then it expands the lanes in around the highway interchange part. So basically what it's doing is just making the turn movements faster and more efficient, which allows the traffic to flow through faster.
All right, so just being stuck in there just the other day, coming from Park City, making that left onto the Olympic Parkway there, there were cars that were stuck in that left lane because legally they couldn't get into that left turn lane. So is that what you're talking about when you're expanding the lanes? We're actually going to lengthen those left turn lanes?
It's a great question. Thanks for asking that one. It would really be like right now you come off, and yeah, that happens all the time because it happens to me almost daily. Like you go off and you can't even go through the light because the traffic's backed up. But that's a single left turn lane. There'd be two left turn lanes there. So what they would do is on each of the left turns, instead of having a single lane, you would get two lanes. And then that is reported to move people through faster.
All right. And I mean, and another one would be to extend the right turn lane there into the Redstone shopping area. Again, so many cars just sit in that traffic waiting to make the right turn, but legally they cannot get into that right turn lane because it's a solid white line.
Yes, yes. Not that I have ever seen anybody drive over those lines and just skip down there. But yeah, no, that's all part of what will be addressed as well. It's really, and that kind of sums up what C is. C is addressing the turning movements along there. But we also are now, just what we decided last night really, and we didn't really decide, but the direction the council gave was like, we don't really want to go down, or we're not inclined to look at option A. We just thought, wow, that's way too much impact, five lanes, you know, just pedestrian impact, etc. So what we asked Carl and team to do was to now go look at option C, but come back with the recommendations. That's why I call it like C.2. Like, what would you do to modify C? How do we make C better? And so that's the stage I would say we're at now, is like taking a deeper look at C and looking at what kind of adjustments we would suggest.
Okay, so what are some of those betterments, do you think?
Well, we didn't get into a lot of detail, but there is one area in particular we were speaking about last night, and a lot of this for us has to do with pedestrian movement. Right now, as you know, we're looking with Dakota Pacific's project. We've been focused on what we call our PPP, or our private-public partnership, which is where the existing library is, the existing transit center, that empty lot that's between that and the visitor center, that like whole block, if you will. And within that, there's an idea that the transit center moves down into what is the empty lot, It doubles in capacity. It gets its own right access to 224. So it keeps the traffic out of Landmark and it keeps the buses kind of down there. But along with that, up by what is where the current library is at, a very large plaza, and we would do a pedestrian overpass, but not like the one you see, say, over 80, you know, by the Whole Foods. But UDOT was looking at going like under the highway, and they just thought, oh, it's faster movement to get someone under. But what we're looking at doing is, how do we get a really nice, broad, very well, and this we talked about last night, you know, they had some examples for us to look at, but how do you get something that's creative and interesting and a kind of a space you would want to walk across? And then when you get to the, what is the east side, you would have an option of either stairs or an elevator just to take you to the pass. So it's things like that. You know, it's a lot of, hey, we like, if we're going to look between A and C, let's work on C. Let's figure out what kind of turning movements we need to improve on, but also let's look at the pedestrian movements. And, you know, we like to say something like that pedestrian overpass. And that's also, I don't know if I'd call it a brand statement, but it's a pretty significant visual piece that someone would see when you come off the highway about our area in general. So we really want to have our best foot forward with whatever those solutions are. So it's a lot of that kind of conversation right now.
The thinking, however, has been that that our brand power was, look at, you're coming into the mountains, and wouldn't a pedestrian overpass kind of like block all of that out?
Yeah, we have other issues we have to look at too along those lines. So just if you put buildings in there where the current library is at, as an example, if you're on, because it's a little hard to imagine maybe while we're talking the radio, but for anybody who drives by there, it really slopes down a lot from where that roundabout is at up by the Taco Bell. You know, like if you kind of go to that corner of the transit center and then you go to 224, really the grade changes. So now imagine you stick some parking garages down there, because we're talking about two levels of parking underground. It gets kind of tall, right? So you have to step things back and you got to look at view corridors. And we have identified in our general plan along 224 specific areas that you have to be able to see the ridge lines. So we have view corridors to manage as well. So yes, all of this has to be taken into account as we consider this.
All right. And do we have Dakota Pacific to build that pedestrian overpass?
The finance piece, like who's paying for what and how that's going to happen, is getting kind of, we're starting to try to unpack and figure that now. The overpass would probably be built by UDOT. You know, wait till you get confirmation. But the way they say it is, essentially, UDOT comes in, they give you kind of the minimum. They give you the version that looks like over by Whole Foods that goes over 80. And then the county, using UDOT's phrase, they call it betterments. You say, okay, well, we want to make it look different. And then the question is, then who pays for that? But I'm not sure who will execute the final construction of it, but it's a part of a process called betterments that you work out with UDOT.
Okay. Let's see. Moving on to the Klein-Dolly request for proposal discussion. This ran way over time. This is the nearly 30 acres of property by Jeremy Ranch that the county owns. It has just over 15 acres of developable property. But we've got a timeline now to decide on a request for proposal by the end of September. How realistic is that?
I think my takeaway last night, you know, when we heard this, I think we were pushing like, hey, we want to try to get this moving quickly, but it seemed like we were kind of far off last night. So I think the timeline is probably a question, might be the way to say it. You know, you want to move quickly. You don't want to sort of lollygag through things, but at the same time, you don't want to rush something, and you want to make sure you get it right. So I think there's a balance there, and I assume, based on what I heard last night, that the timeline will shift a bit.
Okay, so does that mean that you could have a developer at the table by the end of the year?
It's possible. It is possible, but at the same time, I don't think I'd be really comfortable saying yes yet until we get a little further into this. What really, obviously, you know, what we can talk about, like it was a good heated discussion around to do or not to do and what to do there. But fundamentally, the idea was see if you can get the RFP issued and then decide who of your developers that would, you know, build, if you could, make a decision by the end of the year. That's the framework of this timeline, obviously, that we're talking about. And I think we'd still like to do that. But what I heard, say, from Councilmember Robinson, as an example, is he was the first to speak, and he went into a lot of the detail. There's just a lot of details that really need to be ironed out, and I don't think the council is in agreement. I think they're all kind of trying to move in the same direction, but I know you don't have a unanimous opinion, but I think there's even some work to be done amongst the council and amongst some of the staff as exactly what would one want to see there.
Okay. Let's see. The property does create some disagreement among the council. Council member Roger Armstrong in particular doesn't seem to prioritize housing as much as the other council members there. Do you need some consensus, though, to proceed with something?
Technically, no, right? Technically, it's you need, you know, three votes, and then if you get the majority, you can move forward. I think when we can, we always try to, you know, bring everybody along or build consensus. But, you know, I'd be kind of paraphrasing a little bit of what Council Member Armstrong or Roger was saying, but I don't know that he's opposed to affordable housing, or I don't think he would say that. I think but what he was articulating was that he thinks we should have a carefully crafted plan that goes in good detail. And I think maybe this is where there's some disagreement amongst council members, how much of a plan exists or doesn't exist. And so the idea is, I think, as I heard Roger say it, and so this is just me kind of parroting back what I think he said, you know, he really wants to know what type of housing we need, how many workers do we want to house, where do you want to house them. He wants a written plan that it goes into great detail that one could look at. It gives you the roadmap as to how to make decisions around affordable housing. And the pushback on the council, and certainly as I expressed myself, was like, I agree with that. That sounds like a great thing we should do. But I think Council Member Robinson was talking about, you know, the amount of housing we're talking about here would be relatively small. We're never going to overbuild affordable housing. And so I think you heard the other four council members say, yes, we agree with you on this plan. Let's not be frozen in place. Let's keep moving forward with this process, because we still need to do some more work to figure out what this RFP would actually look like and do you actually issue it. So there's some groundwork to be done. And at the end of the night, when Chair Melina Stevens asked, you had four council members that gave the direction of move forward with the RFP process, which for everybody listening, that would just at this point mean identifying what you would want to do there. What would that request look like?
Okay, we got to move on because we've got a lot to get to here. The joint meeting with the Eastern Summit County Planning Commission. One of the biggest things before the Planning Commission and Council is Cedar Crest. This is the town size development proposed for Hoytsville. I know there's limits on how you can talk about this, but you did ask about the village overlay zone in general. It's the code that allows the proposal. So what did you hear from the Planning Commission?
Well, I personally was curious. You know, I wanted to hear them explain it. I'd heard in a joint commission meeting before some of the Eastside planning commissioners expressed that they were in favor of the overlay zones, or they were positive about it. And so I wanted to get or understand that perspective more. Speaking only for myself and just my perspective of an overlay zone, what it allows property owners to do in a way is they get to bypass incorporating. So essentially what it is you take an area like Wanship, and if you got a lot of landowners, they can bundle together, and then they say, we're going to join in on this overlay zone, and it allows you to build a lot of density and like city-like services. And so it's an interesting one to me, because obviously if you're the landowner across the street who doesn't want to be part of it, you know, this would impact you, right, if you liked the ranching community you're in. And so normally you go through an incorporation process, and then there's votes that take place, and then my understanding is that wasn't successful in the past, so they choose to go with this overlay zone. The overlay zone, I think on probably the positive side, was this idea of saying, look, you have areas, and we'll use Wanship as the example, that we all think of as a town or like a town center or city, or is kind of function as an area. So it allows those areas to develop, and that's kind of spread on the east side of the county and several other areas. So I just really wanted to learn and hear from the Eastside Planning Commissioners what their take on this was and why they were in favor of it and what their thoughts were.
Okay. What's the wrinkle with the new subdivision law, though, from the state legislature? If we rezone areas for the village overlay, does that mean that council doesn't control what happens there afterward?
Yeah. And honestly, like, I think I'm going to need to dig into this a little bit more to make sure I fully understand the new law. But basically, the general idea of it is they're trying to, the state legislature is trying to speed things along. And so what they're doing is removing, say, the council or different bodies from where you might have had a voice at the table throughout the entire process. Now the council would be involved in the decision to rezone an area. And then after that, you're removed from it. And it just goes through the community development director and through the planning commission. So what they're trying, it seems like they're trying to do is they're trying to speed things up in favor of developers, and they're trying to remove council members from weighing in on some of these issues. But I need to get a little bit more detail myself.
All right. And another overall issue there for the Eastside Planning Commission seems to be Browns Canyon. Should we be concerned about all of the industrial uses there?
Well, it sounds like from the planning commissioners I guess what I'm trying to say is they look at it like there are some areas where people are doing they're basically doing kind of landfill and private operations that concerns them that they don't think is appropriate there. Yet they can identify some areas where it's happening that they seem okay with. So I'm not sure how you would deal with that on a rezoning. But it seems to be something that is on their radar and that they're worried about is kind of an abuse of that happening in Browns Canyon.
Okay. What's the Browns Canyon history with the Department of Environmental Quality? Have there been other environmental concerns before?
Leslie, I wouldn't be a good person to answer that. I'm not familiar with the history of that.
Okay. Anything
else? Apologize. Sorry.
Anything else you want to mention?
No, just thank you for the time. And if anybody has any questions or concerns, email us at County Council off the website and we'll all get it and respond to you.
Okay, thanks, Candace.
Thanks.
Well, the Board of Colorado Early Colleges, based in Colorado, voted Friday, August 16th, to name Park City's Superintendent of Schools, Jill Gilday, as their sole finalist for the position of Chief Executive Officer. Just last week, on Tuesday, August 20th, 4 days after this announcement was made on the Board of Colorado Early Colleges website, the Park City Board of Education, in a 3-2 vote, voted to approve a 2-year extension of Gilday's contract. So whether Gilday stays or whether she's going has yet to be determined. The Colorado Colleges is comprised of 9 charter schools throughout the state of Colorado, including a 6-12 online course, grades 6-12 online courses, as well as 3 colleges, and also oversees 3 household academies, homeschool academies for children kindergarten through 12th grade. KPCW's Christine Weller will be working on that during the day, and we'll have more information for you later on. Well, friends of Ski Mountain Mining History invite you to their upcoming fundraiser. In the studio with details, I have friends member Don Roll and Alicia O'Mara. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Alicia, do you want to start? Just give us the details of the event.
Sure. Be happy to. We are having a friends cocktail party over at the Canyons Resort. It's going to be on September 10th at 5 p.m. to 7:30. We're going to ride the Orange Bubble up and go to the Lookout Cabin, have cocktails. It should be with heavy appetizers and open bar. And we're going to learn a little bit more about the mining structures from Donald and have a wonderful time. And the sunset chair ride down, sunset's about 8:40. So should be a really fun event.
Okay. Cost of the event?
$200.
Okay. And people can just register online. Is that how they do it?
At the museum website.
Okay, pchistory.org.
Yes,
PC. Slash mining.
Slash mining.
Okay, maybe just tell us a little bit about who the friends are and what it is that you do.
Well, we are preservation and restoration of our mining structures. We're the only place in North America that has mining structures you can ski by. So we feel like it's really important because you go to other places to get mining tours like Alta, and they show you pictures and of what used to be there. So we'd like to continue to preserve and restore our mining structures.
Okay, and my understanding is that all of this money raised at this event goes directly to the Silver King mine restoration, Don?
That's correct, and we're very thankful to Park City Mountain and Epic Promise that are footing the entire bill and are opening up the lift and the Lookout Cabin just for us on Tuesday the 10th.
All right. Well, give us an update. I mean, Silver King Mine, of course, Well, it kind of started where the Coalition building was, but long gone. But you can find it right there at the base of the remnants, at the base of the Bonanza chairlift.
That's correct, yes. And, you know, we've started this project to stabilize, save it, and then restore it. In 2021, it took 2 years of planning because it's very complicated when you have a shaft that's imploding and asbestos everywhere. So last year we were able to remove the asbestos from the Silver King, as well as what's called closing and capping the shaft, to ensure that the, you know, eventually the, if you don't do that, the entire building will implode into the shaft as it deteriorates. So that that was accomplished, but you know, no one can see that. But this summer we're actually replacing the entire roof. So I was just up there yesterday, and the entire roof is off. We've replaced all the steel purlins and support structure that was bent from the last two heavy winters of snow. One of the conflicts that many of us have is we're all keen skiers, but all that snow has detrimental effect on the mining structures. So it's we've been able to take, you know, repair the steel. We're then going to put on what's known as steel decking, which will be 10 times stronger than the previous roof. So should be able to withstand even higher snow loads than we had in our record year of 22-23.
Yeah, so other than just looking cool, I mean, could the old mine buildings be used as something else? I mean, maybe workforce housing?
You know, that's a great question. We get that question all the time. You know, these structures were not built to any kind of building code back at the day. So the best we're going to be able to do is guided tours of the interior. And in fact, we've just completed a set of sneak peeks for our many donors that helped fund this very expensive $500,000 roof replacement project. And we've taken them inside and showed them all the equipment and gave them the history of how the mine worked. And I must say, universally, they were all fascinated by the interior of the building. So if someone wants to step up and spend $10 million to make it usable, that would be great, but I don't think that will happen in the near future.
All right. And then there's some buildings that are just a little bit downhill towards the Woodside Gulch area. Are also mining remnants. Will those be repaired eventually?
Hopefully eventually is the right word. So right now we're prioritizing the last two structures that you can see from the ski lifts and ski by them, which is the Silver King and then the Thanes Head frame, which is just off a Keystone Run up in Thanes Canyon. And after we complete those, I think we're going to take a little rest, because this has been difficult. These two projects are very difficult. And then we will look to save the Silver King Mill, the seven-story structure that you can see as you look down into the Woodside Gulch from, as you're coming from either the Payday Lift or Town Lift, and you look to your left as you come down, you'll see the seven-story structure. And that needs a lot of TLC. It's going to be the same kind of process where we have to get rid of the asbestos first before we can actually do any of the stabilization work.
Yeah. How much money have you raised over the years to repair mine buildings?
Well, you know, we have raised close to $2 million ourselves. And then, you know, and that's with grants and partners, et cetera. And once again, the city and Vail have been instrumental in our fundraising. And then there's been about another $1 million spent by the city and Empire Pass Masters Owners Association, which basically saved the Daily West Head Frame, the Little Bell Orbin, and the Judge Office Building. And then, of course, we had also the Silver Star HOA step up and save the boiler room and coal hopper, as well as a water tank in the Silver Star complex.
Yeah. Now, does the state mining division help with any of the cost of closing and capping a old mine shaft?
Yes, we're very appreciative of the Utah Department of Oil, Gas, and Mining, who accessed federal mine reclamation funds to basically pay for the two shaft closures. So we closed the Silver King last year, and in September this year, we're going to be doing the same at Thames. So that's an in-kind donation of almost $300,000. So we're incredibly appreciative of their support.
Yeah, and there's still people around that know how to deal with old mine buildings and what's in it and what to look for.
Well, yeah, we have an ace team that work on our projects, starting with Jonathan Richards, who is a structural engineer, part of Calder Richards. And, you know, he specializes in historic preservation, so he does the structural engineering work. We then have Clark Martinez, who's the fourth generation mining family here in Park City. He basically has done most of our stabilization projects and is currently up at the Silver King working on that project. And last but not least is our volunteer project manager, Brian Buck, who has 45 years of mining industry experience. So it's really a great team. Without those three people, we would not be able to do what we've done.
Well, and Alicia, I mean, that's a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of resources to saving old buildings. I mean, why do you think it's important that we do that?
Well, it's interesting because in 2015, when the Daly head frame fell, that's kind of when I got interested because I ski up at Deer Valley. And it was such a shame to lose a mining structure like that. So I, of course, got involved with Sally Elliott, who brought Donald into our group, and they head up the whole, they are co-chairs of Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History. So for me, it was more of a passion to keep our history and get involved and make sure that we had our mining structures because there are no other places in North America that do.
Yeah, and Don, you want to add to that?
Yeah, you know, we're not just doing mining structure stabilization. We also do education. We do lectures at the Education and Collection Center on Sidewinder. We do ski tours, hikes. We have over 40 interpretive signs that we've put up over the years explaining the mines and the mining structures that are both here today and unfortunately have, are gone in the distant past. So, it's not only to save the structures, but is to educate and promote our mining history. And I think I had we took the Historic Preservation Board up to the Thames and Silver King, first of all, to see the destruction at the Thames. And then we took them by the Silver King and gave them the interior tour. And one of the board members said, "Oh, you're keeping mining history alive." I could not. That was the nicest compliment I think we've ever had.
Great. Again, the fundraiser, if you'd like to help out, Tuesday, September 10th, 5 to 7:30 p.m. You're all meeting there at, the base of the canyons?
Yeah,
before riding
the heritage level over by Grand Summit.
Okay, and riding up the Orange Bubble Express.
Yes.
Okay, anything else you want to mention?
Sure. It's our favorite day of the year coming up.
Yes.
On Monday, Miner's Day. So we'll be at the parade. We'll be at the Sally will be at the Miners Hospital, which will be open for tours, and we'll be having a sculpture dedication at 4 o'clock at the Bonanza Drive at the top of the rail trail, right near White Pine Touring, where they're taking the remnants from the Daly West Steel and are going to be unveiling a new sculpture that will be a memento and a remembrance of all the miners in the past.
Okay, right there at Mile Zero at the rail trail.
Mile Zero.
Okay. Hey, Alicia, Don, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Friday is the monthly Park City Gallery Stroll. In the studio to tell us what's happening, I have Kendall Kelly, the Marketing and Community Relations Manager for Park City Summit County Arts Council, along with the Executive Director of the Kimball Arts Center, Aldi Milliken. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Kendall, let's start with you. Lots going on Friday. Let's just start with you and kind of get an overall of the gallery stroll.
Yeah, so every last Friday of the month, the Park City Gallery Association hosts the Last Friday Gallery Stroll. There's 13 participating galleries, and they host open houses. So it's something that is a great opportunity to go check out the galleries, especially in the evening. There's going to be several on Main Street, but then also be sure to check out Jago and Prospect. Prospector, and then there's actually a gallery in Peoa, and also Create PC on Currents Boulevard.
Okay, and everything 6 to 9?
6 to 9, yes. We certainly encourage from 6 to 9 for everyone to go by those galleries. We have our Create PC open studios where not only can you see our gallery, but you can go upstairs and see our resident artists. We have over 40 local Summit County artists in our studio and gallery. We have 10 artists upstairs in the studio creating art, and it's a great opportunity to be able to go and see all the artists in their different locations. So
okay, yeah, I always like to push people out to Peoa to go see Bill Cranston. Yes. Cranny. Yeah, he's got a beautiful gallery out there just as you get through Browns Canyon, make a right, and Hill Studios, this just on the left about a mile or so down the road. At Aldi, the Kimball Arts Center also on Friday, one of those that will be part of the gallery stroll, has a new exhibition opening. Tell us about that.
That's right. We wanted to kick off the season with something really special. We've got Carl Handel's exhibition called Less Bad, which is a series of intricate drawings and installations in our space. And he really, it's a solo exhibition, so he really takes over the entire space. So all four galleries, there's probably over 60 drawings. They're hung all over the place with different formats, different styles. It's really an immersive experience, and I think it's a great way to start off the 2024-25 season.
Okay, when we talk about less bad than what?
Well, he uses a lot of humor in his work, and I think that title will illuminate itself when people come and see the exhibition, but he uses humor. He wants his work to be approachable, accessible. He uses, you know, a very accessible medium. I mean, it's graphite on paper pretty much for everything, It's really about drawing people in and then using the content of his work to explore masculinity, friendship, and different themes that he's interested in.
Okay, graphite on paper, isn't that pencil on paper?
It is absolutely pencil on paper. Yeah, that's we speak fancy. In fact, he often brings jars of pencils to the exhibition, so people see how he makes his work. It's analog. It's very slow. Works take months and months and months to make. But yeah, it's pencil on paper. It's anything that a third grade kid first grade kid would use.
Oh yeah, but there are different pencils, and I remember, right? There's the yellow pencils,
there's the HBs and the number fours, and he actually has he's very specific about the pencils that he uses. And the paper that he uses. So he's very controlling in the way he makes his work, but you can see the sort of the way it's very articulate and very clear.
Okay, and he's from where?
He's from New York originally, mm-hmm. but now lives in LA, so he's very much part of the international art scene. He has exhibitions all over the world, so we're really, it's extraordinary that he's both spent so much time. It's about a week and a half of installation and putting this show on. He'll be here at the opening so people can meet him. He's very accessible. It's great for our artist community to kind of walk through all the galleries and then also see what we have at the Kimball Arts Center.
Okay. Does he give any kind of art talk, or he'll just be there?
We're going to be doing programming all throughout the next 3 months. This goes to December 1st, so we've got, you know, how to look at contemporary art. We'll do a collaboration with the Film Institute. He'll come back in November to do a formal talk. Right now, it's too much. There's too much going on. We want people to sort of see what's happening, kick off this vibrant season that we have going on here in the community, and then he'll come back in November.
Okay. And then, Kendall, we also got lots of other stuff happening this weekend. You want to kind of run through what else people can see in the arts and culture world?
Absolutely. It sounds like even just a great night on Friday evening to take out your bike and pedal around and go mm-hmm. make a stop at all the different locations. Mm-hmm. And in addition to the gallery offerings, we also have a show at Egyptian Theater. Booker T. Jones is going to be playing at 8 p.m. on Friday night, and it will run throughout the weekend. Booker T. Jones is a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, Musicians Hall of Fame inductee, Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award recipient. The show is going to be Friday and Saturday at 8, Sunday at 5, and then reduced pricing on Sunday. So there's no opener, and it's just tickets at parkcityshows.com. In addition to that, we have the Miners 9 exhibit at the Park City Hospital. That's a 3-day pop-up art show with 9 local artists and is free to attend. So another one to just be able to make the rounds in that area to go see. And then in addition, we have Park City Institute's Concert on the Slope at Canyons Village. That is going to run on Friday evening. It's I Love the 90s tour. So that's going to be at 7 p.m. On Saturday, there's Sarah Evans, also at 7 p.m. And you can get your tickets for that at Park City Institute. www.thebridgeinstitute.org.
Okay, and then also asking people to save the date for the annual Monster Drawing Rally. This is happening September 14th at the Kimball Arts Center from 3 to 6 p.m. And I believe that this is what, a partnership, a joint fundraiser for both of you?
Yeah, this is something that we do together. I mean, it's really actually an extraordinary program where we invite local artists to make their work accessible. They have a timed amount of time to make art that we all can watch, and then the work is bidded on and bought right there. So it actually mirrors the whole process of making art, from creation to sales, if you will. And it does support both the PC Arts Council and the Kimball Arts Center. Space is limited. There's 20 artists. So we want more. I don't know. I think artists is now closed. The artists, so we can't receive more artists, but our whole community can show up. It's a lot of fun. There's so much energy. And again, the work is so accessible because our local artist community is making work right before your eyes.
Yeah, there's food and drinks that are available for the public, and so if you come, it's kind of a exciting environment. So it's something that everyone's really looking for. You know,
it's high energy. It's really great.
Well, I see it as really stressful. I mean, because their artists are sitting there, and it's like, you know what? They have like what, 45 minutes maybe?
50. Yeah.
Okay, actually come up with a piece of art with people watching them.
Yeah, most people do prepare ahead of time. Like we do give people, there is a submission process. They do think about what they're going to make. And this is what artists do, right? And yeah, it is a compressed timeline, but because of the preparation, because they're in a safe space, because they got people enthusiastically cheering them on, it's really one of the only times where I think of like friendly competition in a time-based way, right? There's so much energy, and you see such a diversity of work. It's really extraordinary.
And then you see something that you want, and then maybe you can explain the process, because it's like you just don't get to buy it. You are one of several who are also interested in it.
Yes, and I'm still getting the nuances of this because I'm fairly new to the Arts Council, but I do know that there is a process to where if more people would like the piece, then there's a drawing scenario.
Yeah, so there's a bidding process. So all the works are $50, and that's also kind of great. People aren't outbidding each other, but you are, you know, there's a lottery, right? And so you pick a card, and then the highest card wins, I think, and then you get to buy that piece. So there's an element of excitement, enthusiasm and mystery that are played along with this.
Okay, tickets $25 for adults, $10 for kids. You do need to go online to purchase those in advance.
Yes, and you can go to either of our websites. You can go to pcsearts.org or the
kimballartcenter.org and check it out.
Okay, any news with what's happening at
the
Kimball?
You know, we've heard some positive news. The city is now sending out an RFP that is the next phase, if you will, in the process of the building. I think that's what you're referring to, Leslie, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, so we know that the Kimball Arts Center is a part of the RFP process, so that we're formally at the table as we're now asking for developers to come back to the city to think about what they want to do there, what could happen there. So that's sort of making the private part of the private-public partnership in a reality. And so that's a really positive step. You know, these things take time. There's a logic to creating these spaces. So we're moving forward in a measured and logical way.
Okay, Aldi Milliken, Kendall Kelly, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks
so much.
Once again, wanted to let you know that the Board of Colorado Early Colleges, based in Colorado, voted last Friday, August 16th, to name our Park City Superintendent of Schools, Jill Gilday, as their sole finalist for the position of Chief Executive Officer. Whether she is headed off to Colorado or staying here in Park City has yet to be determined. Just last week, on Tuesday, August 20th, and that was again 4 days after this announcement by Colorado Early Colleges was posted on their website, the Park City Board of Education, in a 3-2 vote, voted to approve a 2-year extension of Gilday's contract here in Park City. Just a little background on the Colorado Early Colleges. They have 9 charter schools throughout the state, with 1 grades 6 through 12 online campus. They also have 3 colleges and 3 homeschool academies for students in grades K through 12.